What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of Behind the Facade. I'm your host, Gavin J. Gallagher, and on this podcast, I explore the mental and emotional game often playing out subconsciously, both in your mind and the mind of everyone else in the real estate or property investment market. The key to success in this game is to master your mindset and behavior, to take control of your thoughts, your emotions, and most importantly, your ego. Welcome to the show. Guys, real quick before we begin, I have created a brand new accelerator program. It kicks off in mid-May and has an in-person welcome event starting on the 1st of June. I've put a ton of work into building this course, and it's important to point out that this is not a novice level program. It's for people who own property and want to be involved in the property business. It's aimed at time poor business owners, corporate executives, and professionals who might harbor ambitions to build their own property portfolio with the potential to fully replace their salary. Now, you may not want to leave your job, or you may not want to give it up or anything like that, but I think you will see the value of having options beyond selling your time for money. If this sounds of interest, please click the link below to book a call with me to discuss whether or not you're a right fit for the program. I do look forward to meeting you in June if you are, and working closely with you on this exciting journey. Now, back to the show. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode. And a couple of days ago, the Central Statistics Office published its latest findings on their National Residential Property Price Index, the PPI. Now, this comes out every month and it made for some really interesting reading. And the headlines that were sort of on the papers and things like that were that the market has accelerated to 6.1%. nationally in the 12 months to February. That is up from 5.4% of housing inflation, or the growth in the prices. That was just in January. The annual figure was 5.4. Now it's 6.1. And this is the sixth consecutive month in a row that it has increased. And so this will be causing a couple of alarm bells to be ringing in various halls and corridors in the government. Now, the median price for a home in Ireland today is now 330,000. And this is split into regions and air codes, and it's an interesting study. You should look and check it out. But they and by the way, air codes, for those of our international listeners, that those are the equivalent of zip codes in America, or I guess just postcodes that you have in the UK. But 330,000, that is the median number, or in other words, the average. But in the Dublin region, the median, that shoots up to 445,000. And so obviously an average price, there are lower prices and there are higher prices. And so it's just the median figure. If you look at the study of the country, it actually highlights that Leitrim, County Leitrim, is the area with the lowest median price. And so it falls as low as 165,000 for a house in the Leitrim area. Now, if you go into Dublin itself and you start breaking it down into parts of Dublin, then it really gets interesting. Now, the A94 air code, that is the Blackrock area, and ironically it's the place that I've actually moved from. I was living in A94 for about 7 years, and I've just moved into D18. But the median price in the A94 air code region is 715,000, and that's the median. And so, you know, more than double the price of the average. Also, the median for the air code F45, which those of you down the country will know, Castlereagh, the air code there, that is the lowest air code in the entire country for prices. And the median price there is 135,000 per property. Now, what this all means, and it was really interesting when I read it, is that we are now 8.5% higher across the board than the average peak price, that the highest peak price reached in April 2007. So we all talk about the boom And we are now 8.5% higher in terms of prices than the highest point ever reached during the boom. And so this says a lot. And I'm going to leave a link in the show notes for you guys to go and check out the study yourself if you're interested. But what is of more interest to me is the makeup of the buyers, because that gets into what we're talking about today. Now, 50,156 dwellings were purchased in the 12 months to February. And like, there could be some more than that that, you know, didn't officially go through the revenue commissioners or whatever. But according to the revenue commissioners, 50,156 properties were registered as having transacted. Of those, 17,492, or 35% of the entire, were purchased by first-time buyers. First-time buyers that were owner-occupiers. Now, 26,654, that is the number of other occupier, owner-occupiers that are sort of like trading up or trading down or doing whatever it is. But it's interesting that the largest block is first-time buyers, 35%. And then everyone else is mixed into the other block, 53%, with the exception of landlords. So investors or non-occupiers that are transacting, that was 6,000. So just 12% of the market was made up of non-owner occupiers, or non-occupiers, I should say. Now, the first time house prices rose, this is where it's really interesting. First time prices rose by 9.2% on average, whereas second-hand homes only rose by 1.6%. So that's pointing, there's a little red flag there pointing, why is it that new homes are, you know, rising at 9%? Whereas if everyone needs a home, why is it that all homes are not rising at 9%? And this would suggest that something is driving the first-time buyer's market. And, you know, that is definitely the case. Like, look at 9% and the 35% in the overall market. Now, with interest rates so much higher now than they were just 2 years ago, the lower rate, the 1.6% that we saw there for the rest of the market, that doesn't strike me as unusual. When rates go up, you would expect there to be a bit of a slowdown in the market. But 9.2% growth, that is unusual, especially in rising interest rate environment. And so it would seem that what is to blame here, or what's been driving this, is the first home scheme that the government introduced to help first-time buyers with the purchase of their first property. And it's an understandable policy to want to bring out. You want to help people, you want to get them into homes and things like that. But most definitely, it's having an impact and driving prices up in the market. Now, according to the Banking and Payments Federation of Ireland, first-time buyers accounted for more than 60% of all bank transactions in 2023. Interestingly, the report indicated that the average first-time buyer mortgage is now €294,836. And that, they are saying, is €19,000 higher now than it was just 1 year ago. So 19 grand extra is the mortgage. That's how much that they see prices have risen by. And so all of this policy that was brought in to help first-time buyers, what has it achieved? Well, it has helped a lot of first-time buyers, there's no question, but it has also driven up the house price. And driven up the house price has driven up the size of the mortgage. So all these first-time buyers are now, they have larger mortgages than they would have. Now, there's various reasons, maybe, like, obviously, there's shared ownership with these new first-time buyer schemes, and your equity is kind of split between the government and stuff. But I'm not going to get into the detail there. I think what we want to point out today, might the point of today's talk or podcast episode, is that there is always, almost always, unintended consequences when the government interferes in the market in some way. And there's lots of examples of this, not just Irish examples. I'm going to talk about the US, the UK, Europe, and even India. And, you know, these government housing policies, they come in, they tinker around with the market, And they have one idea in mind that they would like to solve, one problem that they're trying to solve. But, you know, everything, there's a cause and effect. There's the law of cause and effect. And everything that you fiddle with has some sort of knock-on domino impact. And in a free market, there is always something that happens from this tinkering with the market, introducing rules, bringing in caps, doing all this kind of stuff. And frequently, the impact is negative. And it is only when you study history and you look at this stuff across the board, you start to realize the negative consequences. And I'm not sure whether government parties who introduce these things, whether it is entirely, you know, wisdom-driven thinking, or is it thinking that's designed to keep government parties in power or get them elected in the first place? There's all sorts of reasons behind it, but it's not necessarily smart thinking to bring in these changes. Sometimes it's put into a government manifesto in order to kind of, you know, be able to go out there, put the talking points out and say, you know, we're doing this and we're going to bring in this change and stuff. And everyone says, oh, that sounds really good, let's do that. But a lot of the time, history will show that it's going to have negative consequences, but it does sound good. If you look at New York City following World War II, the city was finding that house prices or rental prices were all shooting up, and they wanted to keep housing at an affordable rate for middle income and low income tenants. So they introduced a rental cap, and this was brought in, and it kind of, they called it rent control. So they had certain areas of the city were rent controlled, and it meant that the apartment, the rent was now fixed. It could not increase any further. Very understandable intention. You want to look after the people. You want to make sure they're not driven out of the city because of cost and stuff. But it sounds an awful lot like the rent control zones that we've introduced here in Ireland. And if you look at the unintended consequences, it's quite interesting what you see. We see that with the landlords now getting a fixed return, not able to increase it, and despite the fact that inflation goes up, and so you're now kind of losing money essentially on your rent, landlords were no longer motivated to maintain or to upgrade their properties. And so what did it lead to? It led to deterioration in the quality of the housing. And this ended up meaning that there's kind of rundown areas. You might even call them slums or whatever, but this happens. And what happened in the end was, in New York City, there was like a black market of well-connected individuals would be getting the rent-controlled properties. And so you would have a situation, like I owned a property in New York City, and I can remember when I bought it, I was renting it at $4,500 a month. And you could rent a rent-controlled property and get something similar for like, you know, $500 or $900 a month or whatever it was. And so that sounds great for the low-income earners to kind of get those kind of properties. But because of the way, the nature of the market, it ended up that well-connected individuals or people that were like, you know, slipping a bit of a, you know, a bonus or a bribe or whatever you want to call it into the hand of the person in charge would make sure that they get the property instead of the other person. And so that's the kind of thing that creeps in. If we look at the housing policy or the Greenbelt policy that the UK introduced back in the 1930s, in the 1930s, the UK was expanding rapidly, and they saw that the cities were sprawling and they were getting huge. And so what they decided to do is, let's go and introduce this Greenbelt policy. And what it meant was that the city could no longer extend beyond a point. And then there was lots and lots of beautiful countryside extending out for miles, and parklands, just rural kind of agricultural land, wild land. And it was undeveloped land and it could not be touched. And so sounds like a great policy. If you think about it, like, isn't that nice that you have the fields and the countryside kind of closed? But again, understandable intention, unintended consequences. And what it did was it most definitely pushed up the prices of land and housing in the city that was now surrounded by this nice countryside. But it also led to what was referred to as leapfrog development. And that is where developers were pushed beyond the greenbelt. So the green belts extended for so many miles and then they stopped and development could reconsume, would recommence at, beyond that line. And that was the point where they all started building again. And so what you ended up having was, rather than pay the higher prices in the city, they now went out beyond the green belt and started developing out there. And so it created these suburbs that were much further away from the city. And what did this do? It led to larger commutes, longer time spent in the car driving to and from work or trains or whatever. And that ultimately had a greater environmental impact than what was originally intended by the green belt policy. If we look at Germany, the government introduced, now I can't pronounce this German word, but it, the English translation is rent break. And again, it was a rental cap that was brought in. And the idea was there was areas where there was a shortage of housing, prices were increasing because of the shortage. And so let's introduce this cap on rents and then nobody can increase their rent and everyone will be happy. What it did though, is they had certain loopholes where if you refurbished the property to a certain level, then you could avoid that. You could avoid that cap. And this is similar again to what we have in the Irish system. We have got the rent control zones. And the only way you can get, you can break from the rent control is if the property is vacant for 2 years, or if you are going to completely refurbish it and bring the BER level to your energy performance level up by 2 or 3 points. I can't remember exactly, but you go from say a C to a B and that will entitle you to the increase. And so you don't, you sidestep the rental cap. So what did this do? Well, once again, landlords who don't want to will not invest in the property because the rent is capped now, so there's no point. But those others that saw this loophole, they decided, let's go and renovate the apartment and let's really, you know, refurbish it nicely. Let's go and drive it up in price to a much higher level. And what it led to, unintendedly again, is the gentrification of entire neighborhoods. And so it pushed up the prices and it pushed out all of the longstanding residents that had grown up in those neighborhoods. They could no longer afford it because this cap that was brought in was only for the existing apartments. It was not for, you know, significantly enhanced or renovated apartments. In Sweden, the government introduced the same rent controls as New York did. And this was shortly after World War II. Certain properties were now deemed rent controlled. And what this led to, you can pretty much predict it at this stage, this led to long waiting lists for these particular properties. And again, a black market for leases in rent-controlled properties. It also discouraged landlords from maintaining their properties, again leading to degradation in the quality of the housing stock. And the list goes on. I mean, there's examples in France, India, there's all over the place. And the point being, when you fiddle with the market, this is what's going to happen. And, you know, the consequences could be far worse than what you originally were attempting to fix. And so you really do need to be careful about it. And I saw an article during the weekend and they were talking about how the local authority planning system, we did away with what were known as bedsits back in the day. Now, bedsits were the way an awful lot of students, like an entire couple of generations of students would have grown up living in a bedsit. And that is, it's a room where you just have a bed and you have your TV or whatever, and then you share the toilet down the hall. And the other people that live in the place would have something similar. But you don't have to sit in a TV room watching the same TV station, you know, which are other mates, which is what flatmates would have been. And they did away with this. It was considered to be unwanted, you know, kind of maybe sort of too low quality for what they wanted. So they did away with that. But what that's done is it's meant that you now have to buy a one bedroom apartment if you want to do this instead. And now bedsits do sound an awful lot like HMOs as they're now starting to be developed. But we'll have to wait and see how all of this pans out. What motivated me today to talk about all this was I've been hearing about, you know, the latest from Sinn Féin, and they're talking about reintroducing the eviction ban if they get into power, when they get into power. And they're going to bring it in. And what they were saying is that one of the words that I heard was no fault eviction ban. So it would mean that you just simply cannot remove a tenant, like at all, regardless of what they're doing. There's no fault associated. They just can't be removed. And whilst, again, we're talking about politicians and what they say and what they do, this messaging clearly appeals to the base, you know, the Sinn Féin supporter base. And that is why they start to use these words. And I don't believe people just sort of say, oh, let's start, you know, using the word no fault eviction ban. I think all of this stuff gets put into a test. They have politicians and political groups these days. They all have political advisors. And these political advisors, nothing is said off the cuff. Nothing is spontaneous. It's almost always planned. It's almost always, you know, talking points that have been assigned. And they never deviate from the talking points. And it's because these talking points have been tested. These talking points are often, you know, formed in focus groups, and they get kind of like feedback from focus groups on how do these words sound? Does this sound good? Does this sound bad? And it's all designed to get people elected and to keep people elected. It is not necessarily, is this going to be good for the housing market? Is this going to fix the housing market? And what seems to be missed by all of this, these politicians and stuff, and it's, you know, all parties, and not casting blame on any particular party, but words become policy, and policy brings about the change, and often the change is unintended, and it brings about these consequences that maybe you did not expect and you did not want. So when I hear about these no-fault eviction bans, I'm immediately seeing a flood of landlords that get panicked and decide that they want to get out of the market. And what is that going to do? Well, it's going to mean fewer rental properties on the market, less available to rent. And what does less do? What does a shortage of supply do? It pushes demand up, and demand pushes prices up. So what this is going to do, it's going to drive up rental prices. It's going to drive up the demand for rental properties. And because there'll be fewer out there, you might say, oh, well, you know, there's going to be rent caps and stuff like that to prevent that from happening. But I don't think so. I think the market always finds a way. And what you'll have is the market will find a way, and whether that will be renovating the property or keeping it empty for 2 years or deciding just to sell and get out, there's going to be less rental property on the market. Now, the next consequence of no-fault eviction ban, in my view, and this is just my own thoughts on the market and stuff, is it's going to create an insane level of scrutiny on the tenant by the landlord. And so let's just imagine you have a property and you want to rent it, and you've heard that there's a no-fault eviction ban now in power or in place. And what are you going to do? You're going to go and just rent it to the first person that knocks on your door? No, it's never a good idea anyway. You always are recommended to do a lot of due diligence. You know, you ask for bank statements. You want to make sure the person has enough rent, enough income to cover the rent. But you also want to make sure that these guys don't have a negative, you know, history. And a lot of the time people will ring up the existing landlord and say, hey, you know, you've got this person living with you. What are they like? Now, bear in mind, if somebody is a problem, the landlord that they're with is probably trying to get rid of them. And so what are they going to tell another landlord asking the question? Their first thing they're going to say is, oh, yeah, this guy's grand. You know, go ahead. I'd sign him up if I were you. And the motivation there is to get rid of the guy yourself. And so you have to go and dig deeper into this. You need to go to the previous landlord and maybe even the previous landlord. Now, if that sounds like a lot of work and a lot of chasing down and trying to get a hold of people and stuff like that, it is. But if you introduce no-fault eviction bans, what is it going to mean? It's going to mean that some guy could come along and say, right, here's your rent for the first month, and then stop paying you the next month and just decide, like, no, sorry, I'm not paying you any rent, can't afford it. And you're stuck with this person. And we know from listening to the various complaints around the place that the RTB, they are handling all of these complaints to try to get rid of tenants that are not paying and stuff and during the eviction ban. It took 18 months to get rid of some of these people. So what does your bank do while you're trying to make your mortgage payments and you say, sorry, the tenant refuses to leave. So you can't rent, I can't pay my mortgage. What does the bank do? You know, a lot of the time the bank will bring a lot of pressure on you and they say, you have to find a way to pay this mortgage or else, you know. So what are tenants going to have to do? Tenants are going to have to provide a huge amount of history for their next landlord. If there's a no-fault eviction ban brought in, you're going to have landlords being extra, extra careful. I imagine you're going to want to see landlord references. You're going to want to see employment references. You're going to want to see bank statements. You're just going to have a whole history. Where were you before this? And where were you before that? And you're going to have to go out and you're going to have to verify this by ringing people and contacting them and stuff. And if you don't do that, you run the risk of picking up somebody who happens to be one of these bad eggs that, you know, ends up not paying you rent and you can't get rid of the person and you're stuck for 12, 18 months, whatever length of time, trying to remove them. And who knows what other unintended consequences there could be. Like, there seems to be a target on landlords' heads these days. Like, the landlords are the bad guy. And if I move into a new home and I decide I'd like to hold on to my previous home and I'm going to go and put it on the rental market because maybe it's good for my retirement plans, maybe it's good for my pension, or maybe I have kids that are teenagers now, but I'm thinking about, you know, providing a home for them when they're in their 20s. And I'd be thinking to myself, you know what, I'm going to rent the property for the next 10 years. And then when the kids get to the age and they're going to university or whatever, I will just give the property to them and they can all stay there while they're in college or whatever. That doesn't sound like an evil plan to get rich. That just sounds like a parent doing his bit. It sounds like, you know, a lot of small landlords that are out there, they're just plumbers, electricians, tradespeople. They don't want to go down the traditional road of putting money into a pension plan, a company pension plan. So instead, they buy a property and they see that as a form of pension. And at some point in the future, when they hang up the tools and they stop working as much, they'll have at least the rental income coming in. That does not strike me as evildoers, you know, evil investors that are trying to drive up the price of the market. All it is people just making their way. And it just seems like these days there's a big target on the head of landlords, like we are somehow the problem here. I don't know where it's coming from. There's a lot of people out there that are, you know, obviously the housing scheme, this first home scheme that's been introduced, it's obviously working and a lot of people are going and buying property. But how many people are out there, even if you're listening right now to this, how many people are sitting on 30 to 40,000 euro of a deposit account? And that is your deposit that's ready to be put into the first purchase that you make. And until you've accumulated that sum of money, you don't have the deposit to get the mortgage to go ahead and purchase the property. And because of that, what is the likelihood is you're renting or you're living at home with your parents. But a lot of people are renting because they have no other choice. They can't get the money together to go and put the deposit down. And so landlords provide a service to those people who have to rent. It's as simple as that. And there are tens of thousands of people out there who are trying to rent property. We have a lot of people coming into the country for the first time because the labor market is so short at the moment. We want to build more houses. To build more houses, we need more laborers. Laborers arrive in from other countries. What do they need? They need accommodation. They're not going to be buying on the day they land off the airplane. They're going to move into rented accommodation. Again, that's part of the solution is rental property. And here we are in a situation where the landlords are targeted and made out to be the bad people that should be paying more or basically being discouraged to maintain their assets and encouraged to get out of the market and let somebody buy the property who's going to move into it. Anyway, guys, I'm not going to be solving it, but I'm maybe highlighting some of the issues that are out there. I hope you found this one of interest, of value. Please leave a comment below if you can, or send me a direct message with your thoughts. Try LinkedIn or join the school community and let me know what you think in there. but I'd be, love to know your thoughts on just where this is all going. And when you hear things like a no-fault eviction ban, what does that make you think about whether or not you should invest, or what would you do to avoid some of the problems? So guys, until next week, see you back here. Take care. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Behind the Facade. If you enjoyed the show or found it in any way useful, could I please ask you to take a moment to leave a review over on iTunes or Spotify? This really helps us get the podcast out in front of more people. If you have any questions or topics you would like me to cover in future episodes, please connect with me via my brand new school community. You will find a link in the show notes. You can stay up to date with all of my content and the projects I'm working on by signing up for my weekly newsletter over on my website, gavinjgallagher.com. That's all for now. See you back here, same time next week.